Well, welcome. It's fun to see everyone here, and I'd like a show of hands. How many people have actually been in a rainforest before? Uh-oh.
Wow.
So you can't tell any stories that don't have fun about it. That's great. That's a wonderful, surprising. Whenever I ask that question at other things where we're talking about, you name it, places I've never been to like Cuba, or places I've been to a lot like Peru, or you know, you ask for a show of hands, you usually it's about a third. So you're to be congratulated. You're self-selected tonight. I want to introduce our two speakers tonight. I've known John Reed not as long as he has been active in conservation, because John started in conservation before 1991, and he promotes the use of economics to address conservation challenges. John founded Conservation Strategy Fund in 1998 after positions with Resources for the Future, Conservation International, and the Pacific Forest Trust. He designed CSF as an independent technical organization with the aim of spreading economic skills among conservation professionals. Reed's work has appeared in many CSF publications, also in Scientific American, Conservation Biology, Environment, the Journal of Political Economy, Mega Diversidade, and Ambio, both Brazilian publications. Full disclosure, I am a student of Conservation Strategy Fund. While I was at the Moore Foundation, I was pleased to take what I believe is their signature course, which was a 2 full weeks with 35 other people, younger, active, and more intelligent than I, with actually new stuff about rainforests and biodiversity. So I was in awe of my fellow students at this opportunity. And I was actually able to be a hands-on experiential learner of what John and his and Marcos have been doing. Marcos is the director of Conservation Strategy Fund in Brazil. He holds a master's degree in economics and forest policy from the Federal University of Paraná, Brazil, and has worked in conservation since 1987. Before joining CSF, Marcos was the president of, catch this, Speleological Studies Group, an organization dedicated to the study and conservation of Brazilian caves. Additionally, Marcos coordinated the development of a producing forest program, which gained national and international recognition, and he managed the field ecotourism program for the Sustainable Development Reserve of
Mamirauá.
In the Amazon. What part of the Amazon is that?
If you take the whole Amazon, it's right in the middle.
Okay, great. Well, anyway, join me in welcoming John Reed and Marcos Amen. And since we've got two willing subjects tonight, this is going to be a little bit different than our normal presentation. Each are going to speak for about 15 minutes, and then you will have a chance to ask questions. And it's fun because you'll actually get to get up and ask your questions in person rather than relying on the poor moderator to, you know, being your filter. John, I mentioned that I was a willing participant, and I loved being in your course. What is it about economics that can be applied to this question of can the dismal science save the rainforest?
Thanks for the question, Terry. and thanks to the World Affairs Council for having us here tonight. I also, before I answer your question, which I will do at length, want to recognize Peter Rogers, a member of our board of directors who's here in the audience, and Christian Vallejos and Alfonso Mauqui. Raise your hands from our Bolivian office. And Asia Heisler from our office in Sebastopol. So I think the a place to start in answering that question is to rewind to where the moment when rainforests came onto the international consciousness as an issue, which really happened in the 1980s. And it started as a sort of an epic struggle of good versus evil. So we had, on the one hand, we had the rubber tappers, the famous rubber tapper hero, Chico Mendes, and other defenders of the forest in the camp of the White Hats, and they had their allies. And then we had the World Bank promoting terrible dam projects and roads. There was the whole myth about McDonald's chopping down the rainforest to make hamburgers, and very real images of the land speculators in the Amazon, heavily armed and confronting the rubber tappers and the traditional people. And so that's kind of the frame that we began with. I'm going to roll some images here, because when I think people stop to consider the real heart of the problem, what we saw were these economically driven vectors of deforestation, if you will. And there are things like roads, and this is a typical new road punched through an Amazon forest, which spreads deforestation as the land becomes accessible to migrant farmers and large cattle ranchers. Increasingly, we have oil and gas prospecting in Amazon forest, particularly in the Andes Piedmont and the whole eastern slope of the Andes, which is some of the highest biodiversity areas in the world. We have, it's hard to see really what this is. This is the Tucuruí Dam in Brazil, which is one of the original mega dams that really galvanized the movements on either side of the environmental divide. But fundamentally, all these things, as well as the most recent, which is really big-scale agribusiness on the fringes of the Amazon and increasingly moving into the heart of the Amazon, are about food, energy, transportation, and these things which represent, which really are a reflection of demand for services and goods that every single one of us is at some level part of. We're all part of the problem, in a sense. So this framing of the issue as something where there's some bad stuff going on here, and we're going to confront it with an emotional or even sort of a scientific biological appeal, it doesn't work. But it took a while for the conservation response to catch up. In our first sort of wave of leaders were people like Russ Mittermeier, who were putting out their biological information as an argument against these damaging forms of economic development.
That's a big frog.
Or Mark Plotkin, who really made his name as sort of the white shaman of the northern Amazon, and brought sort of sparked the imagination about what's in the rainforest, but didn't give an answer to, well, what do we do about it? How do we address it? How do we strategize? How do we come up with alternatives? And so really, the motivation for the work that we do and what we see is increasingly, especially in the last 5, 6, 7 years, an article of faith in the conservation movement is that we have to understand the economics, but not only of these threats, but also the economics of the opportunities for the forest to generate economic opportunity. And that opportunity comes in the form of things like climate stabilization, sequestration of carbon, products, and this shot is, do we have any acai devotees here? Okay. That's what your acai looks like at the source. When you stack up these products against something like a soy farm head to head, it's an unfair fight, let's say. But the products like this are the basis of economies that are compatible with forest conservation, that conserve culture, and really have some value of their own. So these products have some immediate value and then have some value in stitching together a community with nature. And then we have services, and I hope this will work.
This will work.
What do I do? Just
I hope.
So this is a member of our staff in an area of the Brazilian Amazon where we're helping an indigenous community develop a tourism project. And so this was a sort of, they've done a number of dry runs, but what would the tourist experience be like in a place like this? And we've, Marcos' team particularly has been working on the business planning side of it, the financial analysis, market analysis. And there are, to understand where these untapped opportunities really have market potential, the economics is needed to understand those. And the traditional tools that conservationists brought to the table were not equal to that.
Yeah,
that
scientific studies called showing how bad things were.
Right, and you know, not to discount that, because that is part of the equation. People have to get that imagination fired to want to do something about it, but then that something has to be informed by an understanding of the trade-offs. So three sorts of broad categories into which our work falls. One is strategy. And looking at if there's a landscape that has high biodiversity value and is a priority for conservation, has a high level of unique endemic species, we can't protect everything. And so this begs the question of, well, what should be protected? And this question has a biological answer, mm-hmm. What are the really valuable places, and an economic answer, which are the affordable places to protect? So this particular project was a study in southeast Peru where we looked at a corridor of rainforest that was subject to a certain level of threat from a newly improved road, and went out and studied, well, how does the cost of conservation in terms of foregone agricultural profit mm-hmm. vary across the landscape? Which areas should we target as the affordable areas to conserve? So in that sense, economics is a fundamental input to land use planning, and also to strategy on the part of the NGOs that are active in conservation, looking at how they allocate their resources and what areas they go after. And so this gets knit into both public and private decision making. The second area where we've worked a lot is, I guess you could say, democratizing information about development decisions. So when CSF started our work, we were somewhat unique in that our take on the role of economics was not just measuring the economic value of nature's goods and services, but understanding development and making more transparent the development decisions in terms of who was going to benefit, who was going to lose. On balance, did the benefits outweigh the costs? So we've gone around working with our partners doing cost-benefit analysis of things like, in this case, a road project in Panama that would have traversed a national park and where there was an alternative to take a route around the park. And the guy pictured here is, he's a local contractor and became an activist against this road project because it affects the main tourist attraction in the region, which is a trail where people go to see the resplendent Quetzal.
Ah,
I bet if I ask if who's seen a resplendent Quetzal, not so many hands will go up. Ah, okay. Right.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen one, they're on your ears. So there's an economic value that was sort of latent there, and this constituent of that value, in order to have an answer to the proposal of a road, which is, comes dressed in all kinds of arguments mm-hmm. About economic development, so that he'd have a response to them. Mm-hmm. Which button do I push?
Yeah, so I'm missing.
Si no se hubiese hecho un estudio como el que ustedes hicieron, conjuntamente de CCF con de hecho un consejo así, no hubiera sido posible sustentarle al gobierno de que había una parte económica que nos decía.
And in effect, putting that together with the biological arguments, with mm-hmm. Good old-fashioned advocacy, they succeeded in stopping that road
right.
and getting a different road mm-hmm. built.
So that would be on the western side of Panama near the Costa Rica border?
Yeah, so this is right on the Costa Rica border where there's an international friendship park.
That's right.
Which is a vast area of rainforest shared by the two countries. The spot where we're standing right there is next to a park that's called the Baru Volcano National Park, which is stuck onto the international park. Mm-hmm. So it makes part of a bigger mosaic. And the road would have severed the volcano park from this much bigger and more ecologically viable ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So that was what was at stake there.
Right.
So the third area. And I had a chocolate bar that was in my bag that I was going to wave around and maybe let you guys taste. It's in the back there. But is looking at of the potential small enterprises that happen at a scale and in such a way that is compatible with forest conservation in the immediate environment. There have been, going back to the early 90s, many different ideas. So think rainforest coach. And there's been various sort of incarnations of that over the years. Attempts to come up with small businesses that are linked to conservation of the forest. Many, many of these businesses have failed, or the benefits have been badly distributed, because there wasn't a rigorous financial analysis that happened up front.
Mm-hmm.
Communities get disappointed. And end up sort of in a worse place than they started out in terms of their attitude about conservation. So if it's made into a commercial issue and then it doesn't work out, that's sort of where they feel like they were sold something that didn't pan out. So the project that I showed a moment ago with our staff member Fernanda being painted in the forest, that's one example. We've also, with Alfonso, has led a project on studying the feasibility of marketing a wild chocolate product in the domestic Bolivian market. So, anybody tried wild chocolate? Wild, so what's the difference between wild and domesticated chocolate? The cocoa grows naturally in the Amazon forest. That's the origin of the plant is actually there. And so, 9% of the cocoa mm-hmm. that one consumes is from cultivated, hybridized cocoa grown in Brazil or in Ivory Coast, Ghana, Indonesia.
And so basically plantations probably in rows and
yeah.
shade trees, et cetera.
Yeah. So it, which is not a bad land use alternative, but the wild chocolate comes from native, naturally occurring stands in the Bolivian Amazon, and people collect it and turn it into this exquisite high-end chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a direct incentive in supporting that product to the people on the ground having an interest in maintaining those stands. And what was a little unusual about that study was that it looked at the domestic market. And it
yes.
did the domestic market in one of the poorest countries in the Americas.
But did you find that it was building on the cultural aspect of the people wanting to use that product or not?
I think Well, Alfonso could answer that question better than I, mm-hmm. but it was really a good product,
mm-hmm.
And that was fundamentally what we found out in market testing it.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager of the company has come back and said, you know, your data has helped me market this successfully in the big cities in Bolivia. And most such projects have looked at the international market and have tried to, you know, be here competing with Scharfenberger and all the array of chocolate. So they've really succeeded by finding the right market niche.
That's great.
Yeah. So those three categories represent a good majority of mm-hmm. the ways that we employ.
So looking at land use and alternatives mm-hmm. to just letting development go on, the second was ecotourism, essentially, using the assets you have there in ways that weren't used before to bring in money. And the third is, again, using the natural products?
Well, the second was the advocacy for development, you know, influencing development decisions. But that's all right.
Well, I can only remember three things.
Yeah.
I took too long to say that. So I think that's kind of my background. And so maybe you can get Marcos going on.
Yeah, again, another full disclosure. I happen to be a member of the Board of Conservation Strategy Fund. I don't think I said that earlier. Let you know that. So I am also here, not just as an impartial moderator, but as an advocate myself. Marcos, tell us about Brazil.
Yes.
And what you do.
So, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm sorry because I need to look at the screen also, because as I'm not a great speaker in English, I'm going to try to distract you with the beautiful pictures. I'm going to try. I'm going to try to talk a little about the conservation economics in Brazil. But before, I want to take you all to a short virtual trip to the country. I want to talk some facts about Brazil. This is Brazil. This is where we're located. We have 3.3 million square miles, including marine area, which transformed Brazil in the fifth biggest country in area in the world. We have the eighth economy in the world, too. Almost 200 million people living in Brazil. And our GDP is around $2 trillion. But what's important about Brazil is this profile of the growth of the population. So this is since Brazil was discovered in 1500. So we can see in the last century, Brazil's population is growing a lot. And this is where the population is living today. And what is happening in Brazil also is that in the 60s and the 80s, this was the flow of the migration inside the country. We have a lot of people in northeast and the north migrating to the south and mainly to São Paulo. And because of this, only 7% of Atlantic rainforest, which is the Mata Atlântica, the ecosystem that we have along the coast, is only 7% still covered by natural vegetation. So there was a lot of impact because of this migration profile. Then in the 80s to the 90s, we start to have more migration to the north of Brazil and also a lot to the center. And today, since the 90s, this is the flow of the migration in Brazil. So there's a lot of pressure increasing in the center part of Brazil and also in the Amazon.
And you might mention that many of you may have been in Brazil, but that center part you showed is the largest wetlands in the world.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about this.
Yeah.
This is my distraction part. So let's talk a little about Brazil's nature, because as CSF worked with nature conservation, let's see what happened in Brazil's nature. So we have six main ecosystems. We have here the Amazon, the biggest ecosystem in Brazil. In the central part, we have the Cerrado, it's a kind of savanna. Then Atlantic rainforest here along the coast. All the big cities are located in Atlantic rainforest. Also the Caatinga, it's a kind of dry savanna, and the Pantanal, the wetlands here in this area. I think it's the biggest wetland in the world too. And the coastal marine area. So let's show a little about each of this ecosystem. So the Cerrado is the central part of Brazil. It has beautiful landscapes, very clean water. This is Chapada Diamantina National Park, a beautiful place to visit. Also this...
This is the state of Bahia, right?
The state of Bahia, see. This is the typical Cerrado vegetation. It's this kind of savanna. Lots of endemic species of plants. And a lot of people living from generating income from using the natural resources. This is the famous golden grass of the Jalapão region. Jalapão is one of the places we already have projects there. This is a very beautiful handicraft that they made with this grass. So the Atlantic rainforest is this part along the coast. We have also a beautiful forest, a lot of rivers. The Atlantic rainforest has a lot of mountains too, all the range of mountains along the coast of Brazil. This is the first national park in Brazil, which is Itatiaia National Park. It was created in the 30s, 1930. This is the second national park in Brazil, the Iguaçu Falls National Park. It's a place to visit in your life. Mm-hmm. As only 7% of the natural cover of the Atlantic rainforest exists, there's a lot of endangered species. This species of monkey is the black-faced lion tamarin. The researchers believe that only 300 of these monkeys exist in nature. So this picture will have almost 0.5% of the total population of the species. Right? And a kind of different type of people living in Mata Atlântica. All the three biggest cities in Brazil are located in Mata Atlântica: São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, and Salvador. The Caatinga is the only 100% Brazilian ecosystem. The Caatinga only exists in Brazil. It's an interesting place where the rivers can have signs, but they don't have water sometimes. it's a very dry place. It's a dry forest. And also because of this, it's one of the poorest regions in Brazil. And the Pantanal, the wetlands, it's about wildlife. In Pantanal, we can see the
this, I have a very, I'm very proud of this picture. I took this picture, in
but I was in a boat. I wasn't walking with the. But if you want to go to Brazil to try to see the big jaguar, Pantanal is the best place. And also the wetlands. This is the dry season, so in the flooded season, all of this is covered by water. And also traditional people in Pantanal, these are the Pantaneiros, which are the people that works for around 200 years with the cattle ranching in Pantanal, which is a very specific type of cattle ranching. And Costa Marim, you should know the beautiful beaches in Brazil. A lot of endangered species too. This is the humpback whale in close to Abrolhos region, another place where we already have projects there. And a lot of fishermen working and living from the natural resources too. And the Amazon. Of course, in the Amazon, when you talk about Amazon, most of the people think about the forest, but Amazon is not only forest. Amazon is also the big rivers. This is the Madeira River. Also, white sand beaches. This is the Tapajós River. One of it's called the Brazil, the Amazon Caribbean. And the wildlife, the big black caiman, a lot of monkeys in Amazon, and also a lot of birds in Amazon. And also the traditional communities. These are the riverine people. We have also the indigenous people. This is Surui, where we have project this tourist project we are working with. And most of the population in Amazon is very well integrated with the nature. So, and after talk about the Amazon, let's see a little what's happening to the nature in Brazil. So I showed a lot of beautiful things, but not everything is beautiful in Amazon. So this migration process I showed at the beginning is generating a lot of deforestation, mainly because of the roads. The roads are a big vector of the deforestation. So this is the result of when we started to open the forest for cattle ranching. And this is the final result. So a lot of deforestation along the roads to a very low profit cattle ranch. And I'm gonna talk about two examples of CXF work in Brazil. One of them is connected to this problem of the roads. The BR-309 is this road connecting Porto Velho to Manaus. This is the region between Madeira River and Purus River, which is one of the most important regions in terms of biodiversity and endemic species in Brazilian Amazon. And this road was built on the 70s, but it was abandoned. And in the 80s, the end of the 80s, the forest took it back. The road, it's impossible to cross the road now because all the pavement was gone because there was no maintenance of the road. And then now the government has the project to rebuild this road. And it's a very bad idea because it's a very important region. There's very many other options to the transportation in this region. So we decided to
not the least of which was to use the rivers.
Yeah, the rivers and also another option here because the main demand of this road is because of the soybeans from Mato Grosso, which is mm-hmm. here. So, but there's other options to flow the soybean to the Amazon River here. Mm-hmm. So we decided to make a study. So in as the final result of our study, we find out that more than the project will cause more than $150 million of losses, only considering the investment and maintenance cost compared to the cost, the reduction cost of the transportation. If you include the environmental costs, we're gonna find more than $1 billion of losses. If you include the carbon emissions, losses of biodiversity, and other kind of losses, tourism and this kind of stuff. And the interesting thing is that we find these values using the same tools of transportation ministry. So it's very hard to argue with the results. So we also made a study related to the mitigation costs of the road to how much is necessary to avoid the deforestation the road can cause. And we find out that almost the same cost of the road is needed to mitigate the environmental impacts. So as a result of this study, and of course there was many other efforts of other organizations working, but as a result of this study specifically, the project was stopped until the environmental safeguards are created. So at that moment, we were able to stop the project. And then there was an agreement between the Transportation Ministry with the Instituto Chico Mendes, which is the kind of Brazilian National Park Service, to generate enough funds to create 29 protected areas along the road to avoid the deforestation. And why it was different from the other approaches? Because it changed the discussion. The discussion was money against biodiversity before, and then we changed it money against money because it was the same. When you use the same unit is very, it's much easier to make your point. And also, it translated the environment impacts into the development language. So we were talking the same language. There was nothing different between the arguments. And also, it showed decision makers that the project is bad for the environment and also for the society. So the project wasn't good, even in the environmental side and also for the society. It will be a loss of money. And let's talk a little about the indigenous lands, the work we're doing that, and why we're working with indigenous people. This is Surui indigenous land.
So that's a satellite.
This is all deforestation. Yeah. This is all deforestation. I think it's very easy to understand why work with indigenous lands is important to avoid deforestation. They are doing a very hard job here keeping the forest in the place, because there's a lot of pressure along all the boards of the indigenous lands. So what we are doing with the indigenous people, we are developing business plans for sustainable projects. So they have a lot of pressure from outside the indigenous lands, so are trying to develop alternative income for them inside the using the in the sustainable basis the natural resources. We are doing financial plans for indigenous lands because they need the protection programs. So we are doing long-term financial planning and try to use this to guarantee the financial sustainability to the areas. We are also developing socioeconomic studies because this is the social part of the work. We need to understand what the communities need to improve their welfare. We are starting an income monitoring program now. We need to know how much they are generating of incomes with the resources. And this is important to rank the most important activities they can have, and also to figure out how what's the best strategy to improve their income. And also we are working with payment for environmental services opportunities in indigenous
which
lands.
Is code speak for?
It's to receive mainly money from carbon credits. They're working with RED projects, reduced emissions from deforestation degradation. Okay. And why it's different also, again. Because CSCF is the only organization in Brazil with highly qualified economists working in the field. We have a lot of very good economists in Brazil, but most of them are inside the offices or
working for
or in an academy, and we have very high qualified economists working in the field. And this is very important to understand and to be able to develop appropriate strategies to solve their problems. Decision making based on real information about the community's welfare. This is important too, because we are trying to measure the welfare of the communities, and decision making is based on that information. And also alternative income based on feasible proposals, because there's a lot of work trying to generate income alternatives, but they are very disconnected with the market. So we're trying to make this connection and propose real and feasible alternatives. And this is a workshop when we started the tourism program with the Suruí people. That's me, that's Roberto, that's Ederson, and that's all the Suruí people. So this is some work with the tourism project we have also with Parintintin people. This is a beautiful river, the Igarapé Traíra. It's very nice to swim. This is a party the Suruí people made for us. When it's a kind of celebration when we finished the business plan. It was a 3-day party. It was really nice. This is Fernanda, hardworking. This is after one of our workshops there. She was. It's very nice at sunset. All the children come to swim in the river, and we are always there with them. And sometimes the work really can be hard. This is the river was crossing the road. This is the rental car gave us the wrong car. We asked for a truck. They gave us this. It was very fancy to be in this car in this place. And sometimes the hard work can be really fun, like this. This is part of the work, too. This is the Igarapé Traíra. I was very comfortable inside the boat. People were trying to take us out of there. So the work is hard, but sometimes can be really fun. He was trying to keep the boat floating. And I think at this point I had to stop filming to help them to push the... So I need to help them. So this is what I wanted to show you. Thank you very much. This is a sunset in Rio Negro, close to the Manaus city. And this is the image. I want to finish this presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now we're delighted to open up for questions from the audience. If anyone has something that they would like, please. Oh, excuse me. Could you just go up to the microphone first?
Is it work?
How do you guys source projects?
It's okay. We'll get it going. It's mainly to record it because this will be available as a podcast. So we want to make sure that people can hear you.
How do you guys source projects?
So, good question. The way it works is, the organization has two main ways of working. One is giving courses where people come to a classroom and learn about the economic tools, how do you do economic analysis. And those courses, we do one every year at Stanford with a partnership with the university, and then we do about a half dozen in different parts of the world. So this year we did them in Micronesia, Uganda, Brazil, Peru, Bolivia, and I'm probably forgetting another one, but that's a representative sample. And then the research projects often grow out of a training, of some modality of classroom training that we do, brings people in, and then they see the challenges that they've been confronting for a long time, how they see in the course, well, now I can see the kind of economic approach that could help solve this problem or shed light on it. So that's how a large majority of our projects are sourced through the training program. There are definitely exceptions where a government or a non-governmental organization will come to us and ask us to work with them on an analysis independently of that. But it's all demand-driven by what people need in the field.
And a good example might be the United States Agency for International Development, because you've done several projects at their behest, haven't you, in Brazil?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right. So we have a large project right now with the U.S. Agency for International Development looking at the impacts of infrastructure development and how to reduce them in Brazil, the tropical Andes, and East Africa, and a little bit in the Himalayas. There's that sort of partnership. But then within that, we'll embed the training program. And it's often, in a way to give us a reality check. Mm-hmm. If we cook up a project and say, we're going to go study X, and that's important, that might not be really grounded in what local conservation actors need. And the training gives us a feedback loop into what's really relevant for people, which is important because at the end of the day, they're the ones that have to use the results and push the results and really work to make them have impact.
One of the interesting things about the courses that you give is that it's not just conservation biologists from the jungle or from places like Fiji. There were those in my class. But you've also got people from the World Bank. You've got people from U.S. Agency for International Development. You have people from foundations who are interested in supporting this type of work. So it's a very good cross-section.
And in Brazil, we have a lot of people from governments, too.
Government as well.
State and federal government. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Yes, sir.
Yes. How is all this playing out in terms of similar and how is it different from here, where it seems like you have a vocal minority of informed people who are trying to mitigate the cost of development and a much hugely over a much greater funded development situation? And what is what's the government like, really, aside from its rhetoric? What does the average person think of, say, indigenous people or the erosion of valuable lands and environmental damage and so on? Is the awareness less or greater or similar?
Qual é a atitude no Brasil sobre o meio ambiente no geral? O cidadão normal, o que que acha sobre o meio ambiente? Uh-huh. E aqui o que o senhor colocou é que tem uma minoria informada que tenta salvar o meio ambiente e a maioria sem consciência.
Uh-huh. Okay.
E como é igual no Brasil? É diferente?
Yeah, I think it's very similar in Brazil. Most of the people really don't care that much about the nature. But the portion of the population that cares about the environment, it's increasing. And most of them are in the main markets in Brazil, in São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro. It's funny because people that is living in big cities in Amazon, for example, in Manaus or Porto Velho, they don't want to have a relationship with the forest. They kind of deny the forest, and they want to have a lifestyle like São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro. In São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, people want to live in the jungle. So it's kind of funny. But I think the situation it's quite similar to the United States. Most of the population don't care that much about the environment.
Marcus, another part of the question had to do with the attitude of the government towards the environment and the work that you're doing.
Yeah, we passed a good time about the development of environmental policies, but the two last federal governments was kind of terrible for environment. They destroyed a lot of the policy was made. Because we created the laws, but the laws didn't work. When we start to make the laws work, the government start to change the laws because it was kind of when the environment start to really have impact on the decision making, on the business, the agribusiness, the cattle ranching, there was a lot of political pressure to start to change the laws. So we are living this moment now. It's our president Dilma Rousseff is a development person. So she was the mother of the program of to speed the growth of Brazil. So she's the mother of all the roads and dams projects. So it's we're living a really hard moment for the environment in Brazil. And lots of organizations are trying to figure out how to face this new situation. So that's it. It's a hard moment. it's not too easy to.
Thank you for your work. I read today that the Brazilian National Development Bank approved a major financing for the Monte Rio Dam,
okay.
And I was surprised to see, frankly, that we're still developing such massive dams. And I guess my question is really around after, for me, having observed the impact of Tucuruí and the kind of deforestation and the societal impacts and the economic impacts, what kinds of mitigation is required studies, and are there any redeeming opportunities for economic development around the outskirts of a major infrastructure development project like that?
Yeah, we have a very fragile structure to define the mitigations of the dams. I have one example that for me is it's very symbolic. We have a dam project in southern Brazil, in Santa Catarina, called Barra Grande. The environmental impact report said that there was nothing important to be flooded by the dam. So when they finished the dam, they start to fill the lake. They discovered that the most important, the last big portion of Araucaria forest, which is the only Brazilian conifer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The last big forest of the Araucaria will be flooded by this reserve, this dam. So for me, it was very symbolic, and they filled the lake. So there was a big mistake in the environmental impact report, and so the policy instruments are not working. So it's really hard to guarantee the mitigation of this project.
Now I'm going to say something hopeful. We were just at a meeting a few weeks ago of a group of organizations that are banding together to focus on energy issues and the impacts that they have on ecosystems in the Brazilian Amazon. And we were shown some data from the latest additions of capacity to the Brazilian grid. And there are auctions of new licenses that are coming in 50% wind projects. And one reason that the wind projects are competing is because it's so difficult to get dams built in Brazil. So the Belo Monte Dam, which is an emblematic, very big project that James Cameron went down to protest, was proposed in the 80s. And it was almost built in the late 80s. And activism, indigenous activism, stopped it. They radically changed the design of the project. Between 1989 and today, when it is actually being built, a whole bunch of protected areas, national forests, indigenous territories were declared in the middle Xingu Basin, which was originally threatened by the original projects. And now we're, 25 years later, some of those rights and protected areas and environmental consciousness is consolidated. So I think they're real. Bad things keep happening, but there is an evolution of not losing all the time, and that the market forces really are starting to kick in, where the alternative sources of technology, that's the other thing, is like wind turbine technology in the late 80s was nothing like what it is today. And sometimes if you create a speed bump, it's enough to allow a different outcome to occur. So I think that there's enough friction that's been created in the approval of mega projects today that alternatives are, relatively speaking, more attractive.
And there's a big movement now in Brazil to really focus on Belo Monte to try to monitor all the implementation of these mitigation measures. So we need to have arguments for the next projects and to guarantee that the mitigation is being done.
On the CSFs, or the CSF study slide, it said that the environmental cost of building that road was going to be $1 billion. Where does that number come from, and how do you guys come up with numbers like that?
From the mostly of this environmental cost of the road comes from the carbon emissions, which is based on the historical profile of the deforestation with the roads. So this is a business as usual scenario. So we based on this scenario we calculated it's There was a lot of studies involved is carbon, biodiversity, tourism, and water. These are the main values of the what it was considered in the deforestation. But the big part of this cost is carbon emissions.
Do
we
have any other questions?
When you look at the economies as they exist, and specifically you were talking about income monitoring of populations to see if their income or their livelihood, I'm assuming, improves. Are you also looking at the informal economies within communities outside of the market?
So non-cash.
Right.
Yeah, this is why we're starting to developing some kind of methodologies to evaluate socioeconomic aspects of indigenous people. Because depending on the level of the connection with of these communities with the market culture, they have a more or less monetary incomes. So we already work with a very isolated indigenous lands within in northern of Pará state, almost at the border with Suriname. They are very isolated, so most of their income is not monetary. They are hunters, fishers, and they harvest fruits and other stuff from the forest. So if you go to develop, if you apply a traditional socioeconomic methodology, they are going to be very, very poor, but they don't need money that much. So we are trying to adapt some kind of socioeconomic methodologies to evaluate this shadow income they have.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I want to thank the audience for your terrific questions, and please join me in thanking John Reed and Marco Zaman for this great evening and great interview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.